Hello and welcome to Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. My name is Emily, and today I will be interviewing Rob Miles. Back in March of 2020, theaters shut down across the world due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Rather than closing up shop, actor Rob Miles formed a Shakespeare reading group over Zoom, a group which quickly transformed into an online theater company, The Show Must Go Online. Since then, TSMGO has performed the entire Shakespeare canon, premiering a new production every week throughout the pandemic. They've involved actors and theater makers from across the world, and every performance included guest speakers, with luminaries like Ben Crystal and Simon Russell Beale joining in on the fun. All of the performances are still up on YouTube and have garnered tens of thousands of views across the globe. Rob Miles joins us from his home in Glasgow. He is an actor, author, director, stage fighter, and creator of the Shakespeare Deck, which aims to make Shakespeare simple on the go. Today, he'll be joining us to talk about how The Show Must Go Online developed, the process and challenges of creating Zoom theater so quickly and at such a high level, and his views on how we can make Shakespeare and theater in general more inclusive and accessible going forward. So without further ado, here is Rob. Hey Rob, how are you?
I'm doing fantastically well, thank you. Yes, having a great time right now, raising my five-week-old daughter.
You're 5 weeks old. Oh my goodness. And she was born when?
She was born on March the 19th, which is a year to the exact day from when The Show Must Go Online was launched. So uncanny timing already.
That is insane timing. And you were telling me this just beforehand, but tell me what happened with her when she was 0 days old with The Show Must Go Online?
Yeah, she actually made a cameo presenting the award for best production at the TSMGO Groundlings Choice Awards, which was mainly due to us having an adrenaline high and being able to get in a cheeky pre-recording, which we then sent over to our amazing associate producer, Matt Rhodes, who then threaded it into the show at the last second in order to be able to share our news with all of our amazing groundlings who have done so much to support us over the last year. So felt like it was the right group of people to share that special day with.
That's so beautiful. And then we may be throwing some words out here for people who aren't as familiar with The Show Must Go Online. So The Show Must Go Online, you guys at the start of the pandemic took to Zoom Theater to produce a Shakespeare play every week to incredible success. And then your groundlings were the audience members, just like the groundlings that came to see Shakespeare's plays at the Globe in his day, but except of course they were on YouTube comments and various online platforms. So go ahead and tell us about sort of the start of that process and just explain to us what The Show Must Go Online is.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. So The Show Must Go Online, as you've succinctly summarised already, was a Shakespeare play once a week, every week, for 36 weeks, with the addition of four what are called pop Shakespeare shows, which were written by the incredible New York Times bestseller Ian Desher, which are popular Hollywood blockbusters that have been reworked into blank verse iambic pentameter, so Shakespeare style. And we had Back to the Future, Star Wars, Mean Girls, and Clueless in addition. And then we also had his A Christmas Carol as one of our Christmas specials, directed by our associate director Emily Ingram, and we've since gone on to start looking at the Apocrypha, so we've had Pericles, directed by Mariam Grace now, we've also had Galatea just recently, directed by Rachel Chung, so we've kind of, the mission is evolving all the time, and that was as true in the first week as it is now over a year later. So in the first week I casually put out a tweet and said, would anyone like to form a Shakespeare reading group? Because I had just lost a gig that was going to take me through April of 2020. And the same day I saw seven or eight other friends saying the same thing. And I was like, this feels like the crest of a wave. What can we do? I live in Glasgow, and obviously the centre of theatre culture in the UK is in London. So I already feel quite disconnected and quite a way away sometimes from the heart of the action, as it were. But because I also do innovation work for multinationals, I was already familiar with Zoom as an online platform. I don't want to say before it was cool, but before it was cool, before most people knew about it.
You're an online hipster.
Yeah, exactly. Such an online hipster. Absolutely. An online conferencing tool hipster. That's, yes. That's my very specific niche. absolutely. And so that inspired me really to think about creating an online reading group. You know, I tried to mount a reading group a couple of times in Glasgow, where I'm based, for various reasons, including me getting some work down in London and having to go down and do that. It never really got the wheels under it. But with COVID and the fact that it felt like the safest thing to do was stay at home, I decided, you know, we've got this conferencing tool, and I know on this conferencing tool that there's something called gallery view, and you can turn your camera off and then you disappear, and you can turn your camera on and then you appear. And that's like on stage, off stage. So we could do readings on Zoom. Why not? So I put a tweet out, and it's important to mention that I'm in no way an influencer. So I did not have, you know, a massive following or anything. People weren't gagging to hear what's the next thing that's going to come from Rob Miles. It was literally just an innocent idea that was like, would people like to get together and read Shakespeare? And it turns out that they did in overwhelming numbers. And so within the first few hours, we had hundreds of likes and retweets and comments and all that kind of thing pouring through. And then it very quickly became apparent that we were going to have to take this idea and turn it into a project. And so for that, I turned to my wonderful wife and producing partner, Sarah Peachy, who did an amazing job putting together the architecture of how we could actually run this thing. That then progressed iteratively over the 36 weeks. You know, the most complicated thing that we had to do in the first production was pass a letter from one screen to another. And that was something that we spent maybe half an hour on. And then by the time you get to the end of the run, you know, we finished with The Tempest. We did it slightly. We played around with the order very slightly in a couple of instances. One was to end on The Tempest. But by the time you watch that, there's CGI, there's special effects, there's sound effects, there's magic, there's fire. You really see, if you just watch Two Gentlemen of Verona and The Tempest, you get a really clear idea of just how much we managed to hack the format in that time and just try and innovate in as many different spaces as the software would allow us to with no budget and resources.
Yes, it's insane the work that you've managed to put into this, because I feel like all of us got onto Zoom and we're like, okay, how do we make theater? And you just took that to truly the height of combining almost theater and film at once. You had so many of the live elements of theater and the kind of roles that are involved in theater with fight directors, but then you incorporated things that are so filmic, like having to incorporate CGI or sound design. I know that you had sound effects of fighting in some of your plays. And so you've managed to bring this almost filmic allusion to live theater, which is just the most perfect blend. So when you first started this, how many people applied to you know, actors to be cast in it? And then at the height of The Show Must Go Online, how many submissions were there? Do you know?
Yeah. I think we had over 100 for the first one. I think it was maybe around 170-ish. Wow. And then by the time it was at its height, I think the most we ever got for a single play, I think it was actually Midsummer Night's Dream, which if you've seen the play is not surprising, because it's absolutely wonderful. But I think with that one, we topped out at around 450. For a single play. And bear in mind that obviously we were getting hundreds of applications every single week. So by the time we'd finished, we actually worked with over 500 actors and creatives over the 9 months that The Show Must Go Online was doing the weekly shows. And I'd say in terms of applicants, it was probably fewer than one in five got cast. If we put it that way.
Wow.
We had 100 applicants or more, 160 applicants to some of the less popular shows. So by the time you've multiplied that out over 36 and you realise that the most we ever cast, I think, was about 24, I think, was our largest cast for Richard III, which has the largest number of roles in it as well.
Yeah.
There was a huge, huge response. And while we tried to make sure that we were working with some new people every week, and I actually managed to ruffle a few feathers in my friendship groups, because the first couple of weeks I said I had a no friends rule. So I was like, I will take one person that I have worked with before per week, because I need to make sure that this doesn't become just another kind of insular, same old group of people kind of getting recycled kind of thing. Yes. That you will see inevitably. I knew that the life of this project, or one of the many lives of this project, was going to be in connecting a disparate group of people that were socially isolated, but all across the world. And that was only going to be best served by getting in as many people as possible from as many different places and as many different backgrounds and levels of experience and all that kind of thing as well.
Where were actors, you know, that you heard from who were the farthest away from you in Glasgow?
That's a really good question. I think we had some actors in India, but I think the farthest away is probably only on our second show. We had Sally McLean playing Katerina in Taming of the Shrew from Australia. And so she was getting up at 4 a.m. to do the show. And I think finished the show at 7 a.m. And while we were having an after show party, she was going to bed.
Oh my gosh.
So you know, the logistical challenges, I think, of this show as well were completely unique in that we did have to find times to rehearse that worked with a Petruchio that was in Los Angeles and a Katerina that was in Australia. And we had to make sure that those people could work together with us here in the UK. So, you know, these are challenges that you are not going to find in most theatre rehearsal schedules. So props to Sarah for managing to put that particular jigsaw puzzle together.
So, yeah, walk us through in this extremely condensed rehearsal process, you know, how you went from assembling your cast to eventually showing this, streaming it live a week later.
Sure thing. So I think what evolved organically just out of pure necessity was something that a friend of mine, Dr. Valerie Clayman-Pye, has described as formula as a friend, which is managing to take the best aspects of the repetition, the weekly repetition, to make things really ruthlessly efficient week on week on week. And we had to do that because there was no time whatsoever to spare on inefficiency. So we were kind of striving for this. I don't know if you've seen Formula One. It's kind of race car stuff. So in Formula One, the cars have to go in for a pit stop and they change the tyres because they burn through the rubber so quickly. And they've got the tyre changes, so they can change 4 tyres in 3.4 seconds or something like that. At least that's back when I used to watch it back in the day. It might be even quicker now, but it's just that idea that they can do something impossibly fast. And in order to get through 9 months of this, we had to do things almost impossibly fast, and the two things that helped us with that were people and process. So we had a casting database architecture that was designed by a brilliant friend of mine called Ed, that pulled data from automated weekly application forms that would be sent out via MailChimp to people. So they had a few days to apply. Those forms were designed by a brilliant friend of mine called Kay, who made sure that we were being as open and accessible and welcoming to as many different kinds of people as possible as well. One of the things that I very quickly learned and continue to learn through the whole thing is just how much it's possible to exclude people without even realizing that you're doing it. And therefore how much active energy and investment you have to put into including people. It's not enough to say that you're welcome if you take the effort to come and find us. You actually need to reach out to different kinds of people and make sure that those people feel welcome and safe to participate. And that's still an ongoing process even now. You know, we've just finished Galatea, which was a majority LGBT cast and crew. And that's something that, you know, has only become possible because of the journey that we've been on since the very beginning.
It's wonderful.
But it's something that we always have striven for and continue to strive for. But we gave people a few days to apply, and you would apply to one show while the other show was being rehearsed. As soon as that show went live, we would then, the very next day, start the process of casting and executing the next show. So we would get all the applications closed at midnight on the day of the show before. On the morning of that, either myself and Sarah or a casting director or all three of us would look through all of the applications and look through all the details that people have put in, who might be suitable for what, all the rest of it. Our casting directors would then put a first build together of the cast. Now, this was a really complex Rubik's Cube of a process because we fought, as I say, for as much inclusion as we could manage. And it was always really important to us. So we wanted to get 50-50 male-female with non-binary inclusion as well. We wanted to make sure that it was gender blind. We wanted to make sure that we had representation of the global majority at a minimum of around 30% of the cast wherever possible, and to make sure that that was across a range of role sizes so that you weren't getting black people only playing servant roles, which is something that I've seen theatres fall into the trap of, and it's super cringe and horrible and not what we want to be looking for. And our casting kind of evolved out of race blind originally into something more race conscious as people found that this was a space that they were going to be welcome in, that they were going to be safe in. Word spread, and then we were able to cast from a greater pool of global majority talent as things went along. But as well as, you know, that's one form of identity, right? Nationality, right. Ethnicity. But you've also got a mix of different levels of experience, people from different class backgrounds, people of different abilities, people that are typically excluded and underrepresented in traditional theatre spaces and especially commercial theatre spaces. Mm-hmm. So you add all that to the standard tasks of you've got to create a family, you've got to keep different generations distinct from each other, you've got to make sure that friends look like they would hang out together, and so on and so on. All the things that you normally have to do, you add all of our kind of values onto the top of that, and suddenly you've got this hell of a Rubik's Cube to try and solve, and you've got a day to solve it. And so it was all done on CVs, showreels, and cover letters. We had absolutely no audition process whatsoever. And the cover letters often did make a real difference. You know, we loved hearing from an actor about why they really wanted to take on and tackle a role, because we knew that meant that that person would be coming to us with 100% commitment, 100% focus and energy to do the best that they could with that part. So that's something that I think sometimes actors might feel like that falls on deaf ears, but if you're listening at home, always campaign for your role, because I for one definitely love to read that and love to find out what it is about that piece that excites you. So that was the casting. Simultaneously to the casting going on, while the casting director is doing the first build, Sarah and I are reading the entire play and putting together the edit. So as we went on, we had a series of different associate editors who would highlight bits in red that they suggested that we cut. And
I was going to ask how you did that. Wow. So you did that yourself. That's insane.
Yeah. So we had editors that we asked to suggest cuts, but obviously because I'm the one that is responsible for directing it and I know what matters to me as a director, I knew that I had to have the final cut, if you like. But I also knew that going through a piece of blank text and thinking where do I cut is also a massive undertaking. So I wanted to get suggestions from people that I know and trust. And I was very lucky to have a few different editors. But the editors were asked to run to certain guidelines. So we made sure that the plays were cut to around about 22,500 words, which we found was about a 2.5-hour show. Because bear in mind, this is all done live stream to YouTube. And the YouTube attention span, 2.5 hours is already pushing that beyond any limit that it had previously been kind of used for. And we wanted to make sure that people had a full experience of the play without necessarily having to hear every single word. We made sure that the majority of our cuts came from the male characters rather than the female, because the female characters represent only about 20% of the canon and only have about 20% of the speaking lines. So we tried to do our bit for equity so much as we could by cutting the men's lines
Thank
first.
Thank you.
But of course, we were gender blind as well. So you had women playing some of the biggest roles in the canon with us. So it wasn't necessarily even to do with who was speaking those lines, but it was to do with, I guess, the ecology of the play is probably the best way to describe it. You know, we're making sure that the ecology of the play feels more balanced than it otherwise might do. So we're going through that while the casting director is putting together a build. We take a look at that build, we make some suggestions, we shuffle things around, we're cutting the play down on that day. We then get the offers out, hopefully at the end of that day, but very often on the end of the next day, because it's a complicated process. And then on the next day, we're doing our research and development meeting. So while we've been reading the play and cutting the play, we've also been identifying all the opportunities that are in there for sound design, for what we call set pieces. So significant pieces of action that Shakespeare's put in there. You know, Shakespeare was constantly trying to surprise and delight his audience and to thrill them with things that they haven't seen before. And that really gets more ambitious really rather rapidly as the plays go on. So we found ourselves following this kind of steep trajectory of requirements from it was passing a letter in the first play to a couple of comedy fight scenes in the second play to all out battles in the third play to then witchcraft in the fourth play and so on and so forth. So he really kind of ramped up pretty aggressively, pretty quickly. And we tried to keep pace with that, with our various ways of trying to hack how Zoom works, to kind of bend it to the theatrical good. And as you already kind of very flatteringly pointed out, much appreciated, we did hybridize film and cinema techniques into this as well, because ultimately it would be false not to, because you're still operating through cameras at the end of the day. And so it felt like, you know, we were able with Zoom and basic resources to replicate what cinema was capable of in around the 1920s. So, you know, we were trying to make as much use of those aspects as we possibly could. And our R&D meeting was the opportunity for the whole creative team to come together. And it didn't matter what your role was within the creative team, didn't matter what your kind of jobs to be done were. You could pitch anything for any moment that we were discussing. So a couple of our kind of core principles for working were the wisdom of crowds and greenhousing. So the wisdom of crowds is just the idea that if you have more brains on a problem, you can come to a better solution quicker than if you're relying solely on one person's ideas. And then greenhousing is the idea of taking an idea and yes-anding it in improv terms. So you'll try and find out what's good about the idea. And then you can go on a journey with that idea and it might evolve and become something completely different. But it would never have had the opportunity to do so if you'd have done what's called shithousing and just gone, no, I hate it. It sucks. So basically, you know, we would always try and create a unifying aesthetic for the shows, especially in the kind of back half. We realised that actors actually were really up for creating costume from found items in their home, or, you know, putting a scarf on in a silly way, or, you know, putting makeup on their face, all this kind of thing. In the early shows, I was really cautious because people were donating their time about what are people going to be willing to do when they have so much to do already textually. You know, like Shakespeare's not easy by any means, and everyone is coming to it with different levels of experience and all that. But what we found was time and time again, so many actors actually loved having a tactile hands-on arts and crafts project with cardboard and tinfoil, that was actually a part that they were really excited about. And so that allowed us to really blow up and flourish the kind of aesthetic side of it and the kind of costume.
Right. What
and
was some of the
side.
Most intricate work that you asked your actors to do in that way?
Oh my word. Most intricate work. I mean, Troilus and Cressida, I think everybody's armor. Emily Ingram is a fantastic kind of production designer for us. She was our master of props and costume. And so, you know, I said it would be great if the armor could reflect the individual. And so she found kind of Greek symbology that matched with the characters. So, for instance, Achilles is the son of Thetis, who is a sea nymph. And so he had a tidal wave on a crest on the front of his armor. And everybody had like something on their armor that was like specific to their personality and their lineage in Greek mythology as well. So that was probably like the hardcore geekiest bit. I'd say the most intricate late stage change was in Othello, when a friend of ours, a friend of the show, David Sterling Brown, who is Dr. David Sterling Brown, who is amazing, did our introduction to Hamlet. And he got in touch on Othello and said, have you read this piece by a friend of mine about Othello's black handkerchief and the fact that the handkerchief is often depicted as white, but it was meant to be black because it says it's dyed with
I've
money.
I've read that piece.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. So this blew my mind. And of course, as I'm reading it, I'm like, yes, of course, this makes perfect sense, because it's talking about how the representation of black skin on stage would have often been achieved through the use of black silk. And so this piece of black silk was actually meant to represent his kind of corporeal body as much as it was, you know, his right. affection and the story that is invested in it about the, you know, the witch and all this kind of stuff that embroidered it. And so that was something that came through, I think, the day before the show went up. And so then Emily took to Canva and we went through about four different drafts of what a black handkerchief should look like, emailed it out to all the actors, who then all printed it out and like crumpled the paper up so it was malleable and all that kind of thing. And we got a black handkerchief into the show with about 8 hours notice, which was pretty impressive. But that's that kind of thing really ramped up. Again, week to week, as we found the actors were going to be willing to go for that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, and you incorporated some of the actors' housemates, I assume, into the performance. I know I was watching Romeo and Juliet last night, and you see, you know, Romeo reach to touch Juliet's face, but then it's clearly somebody else's hand in Juliet's room actually going to touch her face. So what kind of, you know, crazy things did you ask your actors, the people that they were living with, to get involved with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So a great one, I'd say, Hamlet, when Polonius dies, Kristin, mm-hmm. who was playing Hamlet, her partner hid behind the curtain. So when she stabbed the curtain, someone actually moved and like collapsed in a heap. So that was a pretty good one. We had someone playing a cadaver for Imogen. So Imogen has to mourn the dead body. And so he just had to kind of collapse into frame so that she could mourn this dead body. We also had Robbie Capaldi in the same play, needed to be in Cymbeline's, sorry, not Cymbeline's, that'd be a very different play, Imogen's bedroom. And so we had his partner in bed as a kind of lump that would stir every now and again when he kind of got too close or whatever. And so you got this sense that they really were in a shared space. Similarly, the same partner for Imogen, who played the dead body in that scene, played his hand in the other scene, so you could see it cross the streams. And obviously, we did a lot of things with hands where there's a way to trick it, so you can use your own hand to stroke your own face, but it looks like theirs.
Right.
And that works really well when the genders are the same, but men do have hairier hands on average. And so it didn't really work so well. And then obviously we had actors of different melanation as well, if you put it that way, where that trick just wasn't going to work. And so there were a couple of pointed uses of gloves to disguise whose hand was whose and when. But yeah, we were astonished that actually, for the most part, you know, the partners were really happy to get involved. And I'd say probably the best example of that was Rich in Hamlet, helped us to create a crane shot. So he was the crane. So he took Kristin's laptop from her during her final death and then stood on the sofa and lifted it up into the air, pointing down at her. So you get this kind of crane shot where you see almost like Hamlet's spirit leaving his body at the end. It was an incredible image to close on. And again, all done guerrilla style, you know, all done zero budget, zero tricks, just a laptop, a bloke,
that's
and a
insane.
Sofa.
That's so cool. So then you went through all of this. You're finally able to, you know, bring this production to streaming on YouTube. And then you have these groundlings, as you call them, who are the audience, and they're commenting during the entire performance. How did you guys work that into the performance in any way? Or how did that affect you to see audience response live?
Oh, it was incredible. It's the kind of market research that TV companies pay thousands upon thousands of dollars to get. And we were getting it for free in an animated, visceral, no-holds-barred kind of way. So we knew what moments played, what worked, what people responded well to, what didn't work, what fell flat, what people weren't so keen on. So we were able to devise the plays with this, what I would call a dialogic relationship with the audience. Now, the audience are in the live chat on YouTube, and we are all doing the play on Zoom. So it's the audience are in a different space to the actors, mm-hmm. and that is the big rule break, I guess, that we instituted from traditional theatre. You know, we are in two different spaces, and other people have responded by getting people on Zoom. But unfortunately for us, in another way, our audience was often over 160 people. Sometimes it was as high as 700.
Wow.
You know, so we couldn't fit that many people on our Zoom account.
Right.
So we needed, because it tops out at about 100. So we had to go through YouTube. But what I think was the real positive experience of that was that you could get this authentic groundling experience. So the groundlings, for those who maybe aren't aware, if you go to the Globe in London, the recreation of Shakespeare's theatre, you will find that there is a yard that you can stand in and you pay £5 for a ticket. And it's the best seat in the house, in my opinion, as long as you're able and willing to stand for that long. But it is, it's an extraordinary experience to be a groundling. However, in Shakespeare's time, you would have paid a penny, and these would have been the kind of lower class people that would have been in the yard. There would have been far more people packed in there. And I am of the belief that it would have been far rowdier and far more dialogic than our kind of sanitized middle class theatre audiences are today. Everybody's very polite today, and everybody kind of honours Shakespeare in a way that when it was new writing, they probably wouldn't have done. And so what it allowed was the audience to have the exact same level of animation and activity within themselves as a group while the show was going on, without it having any negative impact on the performance. And of course, those that didn't want to engage with that live chat didn't need to, but those that did took a hell of a lot of solace from it, because it was a way of bringing together a community that week on week could reconnect with each other, could share an experience together. And that, in a time of lockdown when everyone's socially distant, yes, and socially isolated, was really one of the big qualitative wins of the whole experience, was the fact that we were able to bring together actors that were thousands of miles away to share a shared space and to create shared work with each other and play off each other in a way that would never have been possible in any other medium. But also we were able to bring audiences together with each other from across those kind of different barriers, if you like, that would have always prevented it beforehand. And, you know, numbers are nice. You know, we've had over 250,000 views on our videos now from across 60 countries, and that's great. But better than that are the qualitative stories that we've had, which have been so moving. You know, we've had people with chronic illnesses that aren't able to leave hospital that have been able to engage with the work on the same terms as the rest of the audience. We've had autistic audience members that have sensory overload in traditional theatre spaces, that the flatness of the Zoom medium has allowed them to engage with it much more readily and much more meaningfully. We've even had somebody in palliative care who spent their final hours of life on this planet enjoying the shared experience of something they love, and that was Shakespeare. And so, and that was actually a member of one of the casts came to us, I think, a couple of weeks after that had happened. And when we were just getting started, you know, I like to give a pep talk to the actors about the fact that, you know, this isn't paid, none of us are getting paid, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't matter, and it does matter to people. And one of the actors put their hand up and said, actually, I can attest to that, and here's why, proceeded to tell us this incredible story of this friend of a friend who had kind of reported back to them that their relative had been watching our shows, during their final hours, which is just incredibly humbling and incredibly moving. And I think the universality of this experience, you know, we can all agree it's not theatre, and we can all agree that we're dying to get back into a real space and physical space and, you know, spit on each other. It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
A little gross, but great.
But it doesn't take away at all from the unique benefits and the unique advantages that this medium does have and will always have. And yes, I think that that's something that we need to make sure that we don't lose as we start to transition back into a kind of new normal, if you like, as we go, because I don't want anything to go back to normal. I'm allergic to the phrase back to normal. I think there are massive changes that we need in theatre as an ecosystem. And I think the preservation and evolution of digital theatre as a part of every show's experience and the way that that show can deliver that experience is something that I'm excited now to continue to explore as I'm on the cusp of, you know, trying to start creating work in spaces again.
I so agree. I mean, from those stories that you've shared, I don't know how we can ignore the beautiful things that have managed to come of this experience. And, you know, we're coming to the end of our time. I have a million more things I wanted to ask you about your incredible guest speakers, from Ben Crystal to Simon Russell Beale to everyone else. But you're speaking of, you know, starting to come back into the space. I know that you at The Show Must Go Online just did John Lilly's Galatea. How do you see The Show Must Go Online proceeding from here? And how are you personally starting to re-enter this, as you said, new normal?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to touch on our guest speakers very quickly, just because it is right and proper to honour them. I think they brought something extraordinary to what we were doing, but I think that's one of the many lessons of this kind of theatre that I want to take back into a space. So, you know, you're talking about how am I going to navigate this return to kind of traditional theatre? I am definitely going to be using a lot more sound design and projection and kind of magicianship of the kind that we've had to innovate through Show Must Go Online within a physical theatre space, because I think Atmosphere is something that money can't buy, and it's something that can make all the difference to a show. And I know that time and time again, through, again, that free market research of our groundlings, is that just a little bit of projected footage and a little bit of sound design can just add so much atmosphere that draws you into what feels more like a world than a performance. And I think world building is something that I'm really kind of a little bit obsessive over. And something that I would really like to kind of continue to drive once we get back in spaces. But another thing that I'd love to do is to have people discuss the play and discuss the work, not necessarily in response to the work, because that was the big, I guess, disruption that we did, was that we had these guest speakers talking about the work without having touched our production. They had no idea what our intentions were, how we were going to stage it, anything like that. They were coming to it from a place of their expertise, what they are interested in the piece, and what they are going to get out of it. And I think that was exciting, because it meant that if they talked about something and maybe that wasn't present, or they talked about a choice and we made it differently, it opens up space for you as an audience member to interject yourself and go, oh, okay, so what I'm watching is not definitive, what I'm watching is a version. And if it's a version, there's space for me to have opinions. There's space for me to engage with it critically. And by critically, I don't mean like, oh, this is rubbish. I mean, being an active part of the storytelling. And I think that's something that, you know, you talked about with the live chat. Did we incorporate it at any point? Yes, we absolutely did. You know, we ran a poll on Twitter, for instance, during Much Ado About Nothing, about what punishment Don John should receive for having schemed against everybody. And I think the result was a custard pie in the face.
Correct.
Yeah, correct. Exactly. Right answer every time. And I think that idea of trying to step up audience engagement to audience enfranchisement is something that I'm really excited about. And I've got ideas for how to start to create that when we get back in physical spaces. But those ideas have absolutely evolved as a result of having done this kind of work. As far as Galatea is concerned, you know, it was a smash. It was an absolute smash hit. And I can just say anecdotally from the reports that I've been getting back from the rehearsal room, because again, I'm deliberately making myself consciously absent now. I've assumed the role of artistic director, and I'm trying to provide as much support as I can, but that support is always responsive. So directors can come to me and say, oh, we're struggling with this thing. But at that point, I'm happy to kind of step in and advise or guide if that's what people want. But I'm also very happy to step back and give people ownership and agency, because that's what I would want if I'm a director. But it's also meaning that the medium and the way that we work and the diversity of lenses through which you're seeing the work can be so much more disparate. And I think the more different a play by Emily Ingram or a play by Marion Grace or a play by Rachel Chung can be from a play by Rob Miles, the better for Show Must Go Online. That's a sign of health. And so Rachel did an incredible job with Galatea. You know, it was her idea to have a majority LGBT cast, which I'm pleased to say we were able to deliver. But we also talked about the fact that there were gaps in everyone's knowledge. And one of those was around the lived experience of transness. And so we put out a call for a trans embedded critic, and Frey Qua Hawking got involved and was an embedded critic on the show, which is a first. That's something we've never done before. You know, Mariam Grace really wanted to make sure that we were pushing the accessibility to the next level. She got Jan Guest involved, who's a BSL interpreter. So now the shows have got sign language baked into them as well as hard captions, so that again you don't have to wait for YouTube to auto translate them after. You can engage with it on the same level while it's still happening. So you know, these things continue to evolve all the time, and it's difficult as a creator. And I know Emily Ingram has expressed similar sentiments that you pinch yourself or you kick yourself for not having had these things earlier, but it's because of the groundwork that we laid that we're able to do these things at all now. So, you know, there will always be more work to do. And so we're very conscious of that, and we're committed to doing that. And we're still in dialogue with people about how we do that. So the future of TSMGO at the minute is in flux, shall we say. We know that we're going to wind it up at some point, because it is very much a product of its time. But what I hope that we can do is to continue to provide, whether that's through my work or through the work of other people that have been involved in TSMGO in key ways, can continue to use the platform to inform people about what we're getting up to, but also to offer a high quality digital version of whatever work we create, so that our community can continue to enjoy amazing high quality digital classical theatre on into the future. So it may shift from being a producing house into more of a receiving house. We've got some other ideas about other early modern work and other lenses, distinct lenses, that we want to view that early modern work through. And so we're going to try and do that as well before everything's said and done. But it's certainly an exciting time for Show Must Go Online.
It is, and it is an exciting time for the world that you're bringing this accessible theatre and continuing to make it even more accessible, even as we return to spaces and figure out how we can hybrid what we've experienced in the last year and what we've learned with the way that classical theatre has been shown in the past. So thank you for sort of spearheading that right from the start of the pandemic. And thank you for being on our show. It has been a complete honour to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. If you're interested in learning more, check out our site at nosweatshakespeare.com and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We look forward to talking Shakespeare with you again soon.